Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 61. What if oral sex triggered a near-death experience? Part 2.
The second semester of my freshman year at a party. We ended up in a corner talking for a while and then kissing for a while, and then we did a sort of mild version of dating, I guess, from what I recall. It was college and we had a lot of mutual friends, so we had a good time. I had anxiety issues that he had to deal with and did not deal with that well, but it was amazing that Ian liked me back. I had spent all of high school liking guys who did not like me back. Ian admitted to being very intrigued by me very early on in his first times just seeing me. It was the first serious relationship. I, you know, had a toothbrush at his place and things like that. Ian was the first guy that I had sex with, and I remember a lot of that was because he was the first guy I ever met who I could trust. Immediately I knew I could trust him to, that he wouldn't push me, and he always seemed like a very careful and practical and respectful guy. I felt immediately attached to it and probably felt more seriously about it than he did. I certainly said I love you before he did. Was awkward. He didn't like it at all. And we actually split up not too long after that for the summer. So we had a short few month relationship there before the summer break where we were apart in 2003 and then back together in the fall of 2003. I know he had some worry about being the first person to have sex with me. I guess that's a pretty typical worry that guys have, that the girl will get attached, and I didn't want that to hold him back because I was already attached. It wasn't going to make it any worse or better. We started sleeping together, and I was on the birth control pill. That made the anxiety get worse, and he had a pretty difficult time dealing with my anxiety and my having panic attacks. And it being my first relationship, I was really unprepared for a lot of the things that came up. Just jealousy about his earlier girlfriend, coupled with a sort of frustration about being left out once he and his friends were old enough to go out and drink, and I was not. I didn't know what was important or not in a relationship. I'm not sure I still have figured it out, but Ian definitely got to see the first stumbling blocks. I was blessed / cursed with a high school humanities program that took me through various philosophies. I had a lot of predisposition toward deconstructing things and a preoccupation with the meaninglessness of a lot of decisions. And I think at the time that I entered college, that sort of anxiety was already amplified by the rhetoric that I was surrounded with. Here's your time, decide what you're going to do with your life, figure out who you are, that sort of thing. When I was coming in with a mindset of, you know, what I decide to do here is just going to determine how I fit into an economic system I'm not sure I believe in, like surrounded by people who haven't questioned their value systems and what they're rooted in, etc. And I think when it comes to meaning and value and the reason you're alive and the ethics of living your life, that stuff really becomes highlighted when you get in an intimate relationship. At the same time, I think it also made me pretty interesting and funny. When it wasn't an anxiety attack, it was the same thing that would bring us together because we'd meet somewhere in the middle. A panic attack is strange because there's often, at least in my experience, a rationality behind it that you can't argue with. I would get hung up on how there was no guarantee that I would be alive in the next minute. I would have panic attacks about things like the possibility of a plane crashing right through the roof of the dorm room and killing me, or something inside our very complex bodies just glitching. And you can't really talk somebody out of the reasoning behind that, because you simply can't prove that it won't happen. If you haven't had panic attacks yourself, then I think it also becomes difficult for them to tap into the emotional wavelength you're on and help you from there. I remember things being much more manageable than they had been in that first 3 months that we'd tried before the summer. We were getting along quite a bit. He had said, "I love you" back, which was so beautiful, and things were pretty good. It was a Monday night then, I suppose, that we had a group of people over, and we were doing what we typically did, which was just like smoking a little pot, having beer. I had turned 20 10 days before that. Not a big deal. I remember having a really good night, and then it was the morning after that. I remember it somewhat like a dream. For as fuzzy as my memory is, I remember the room very clearly. The Pink Floyd back catalog poster on the wall. And we started to fool around in the morning. We both had the same class to get to. We had plenty of time. And being relatively new to sex myself, I was just so enthused by this being part of my life. So I remember he was going down on me to sort of get things started, I believe. And so I was lying back and I was looking up and I could see the window. And looking down, his head was under the covers. And so I couldn't see him, but he was doing a very good job. And I opened my mouth to say, "Hey, you're very good at that." And to me, those words came out of my mouth just like they sounded in my brain. But Ian immediately stopped and asked me to repeat myself. And I did. And he told me that my speech was garbled. I don't remember exactly what he said. I just know there was suddenly a communication issue. And immediately felt ashamed and confused. I got up and went to the bathroom, just wanted to take a minute to myself, splash some water on my face. I looked at myself in the mirror and was trying to get things straight. I didn't have any idea what was happening, but I was very ready to believe that I was having an anxiety attack. My face in the mirror seemed uneven, like part of my face was slipping down. And I knew it wasn't an anxiety attack at that point. I managed to get back into the bedroom and I did something that he and I had done off and on when I had anxiety, which was to write down what I was feeling. So I immediately sat down at the computer and started to type a sentence that was to the effect of, "I'm sorry, I don't know what's happening, you didn't do anything wrong, I don't know why I'm reacting like this." And by the time I finished writing that, I felt really, really sleepy. I felt my stress sort of evaporate, as if typing for him would solve the situation, or would have solved the situation, and really wanted to drift off to sleep. But right as I was starting to, Ian had looked at the computer screen, which was pretty much gibberish. When I had looked at the computer screen, I saw everything was legible and made sense and matched what was in my brain, but that's not what Ian saw. And when he then turned and saw me basically passing out on the bed, he snapped into Eagle Scout mode, I guess, recognized an emergency very quickly and yanked me up and, despite my protestations, dragged me to urgent care on the college campus. I remember leaving the room and I remember being annoyed because I just wanted to go to sleep. And the next thing that I strongly remember is being in the waiting room, because that's when my head started to really, really, really hurt. There were immediately several doctors there, but at that point there wasn't much that I could do. I didn't feel very capable of communicating, and I was confused, and I was in a lot of pain. They got me into a fire engine, I believe, to take me over to the actual hospital. First time I'd been in a fire engine, I remember thinking that, weirdly enough, in the middle of everything. I was like, oh, a fire engine, that's exciting. I remember then being in the ER and just feeling like it was too much. At that point, I was able to articulate enough. I was certainly asking them to just let me die, basically commanding the people there to just let me die. It hurt so much that it just felt that this was the time. I was pretty lost in my own world and trying to figure out what the hell was happening, because I'd be awake for a minute and a half while they moved me from one place to another, and then I'd be out again. The feeling of wanting to die, like the request, please let me die, was a very acute, sharp memory that hasn't left me, that I think about sometimes even now when I get really depressed. I wonder about that, like, oh, that was my chance to get out, and they wouldn't give it to me. When you're in a dark place, it can be kind of frustrating to think, like, I had a chance to die young before I had to face all of these other kinds of responsibilities and disappointments and challenges. It did feel like the perfect time. I had had this idea in my head since I was relatively young that I wasn't going to live very long. After that, it gets really hazy. I know that I went through a few tests before I actually ended up in my hospital room, and that's when my memory starts to get focused again. I just remember being super unhappy and realizing that I didn't want anything to do with a lot of the people who were coming to visit me. They wanted to keep me a bit longer than I wanted to be there, which I think is typical with hospitals. To leave, I had to demonstrate that I could walk straight. And I remember my first attempt, I did not do well. I went right toward the wall. My left side was impaired, and I was determined to get out, so I pretty much took a deep breath and told them, like, hold on, give me one more chance. And willed myself in a straight line and was able to be released. I went out to get dinner at a Thai food restaurant with Ian and with my dad. And as we were walking to the restaurant, I was hearing like this bass line. I asked my dad and Ian when we left the restaurant, like, did you guys hear that? Or do you hear that music? And they did not hear that music. So they both immediately became worried. I then became worried because at this point, my faith in determining the health of my mental state was nil. So we got back to my dorm room, which was just about a block and a half from the restaurant, if that. And I went to the bathroom to try and collect myself, and I was hugging the toilet and had a vision, I guess, or a hallucination. I saw two people, would map as a father and daughter, I guess. It seemed as though I were seeing the last scene of a movie or something. They would have been very small people if they were actually in that bathroom with me, but they were walking away, and I didn't actually realize that there was anything unusual about that. And that wasn't an uncomfortable experience for me at all. I was annoyed that I had to go back to the hospital, that much is for sure. It's like an aftershock of the stroke. Your brain's trying to repair itself. The stroke and that little baby seizure, I guess, would have happened in April, of 2004, and then I like pulled out of classes with the intention of re-enrolling. Went home and stayed with my mom for the summer and had no incidents at all except for a ton of depression and confusion. I spent a lot of time with my dog. It was after that summer break, shortly after I had gotten back to school, Ian was spending the night, and apparently, because I have zero memory of this, I had a grand mal seizure while I was sleeping next to him, which in the length of time that I've known Ian, talking with him at least shortly after all of these events, that seemed to be one of the scariest things for him. Apparently I wet the bed and I was shaking and all of this, but no memory of it at all. The timeline here is weird. I had a couple of like super inconvenient seizures. One of them I was able to get back home from the hospital and get back in bed and fall back asleep, and then had another seizure, much to Ian's dismay. They put me on a dosage of Dilantin, and I think at this point Ian had decided that he was going to go on a road trip. Things hit ahead for Ian around that time. You know, he's a couple years older than I am, so he was getting ready to graduate, and I was just like, hey, I'm having a bunch of problems. I never stop having problems. I'm in the hospital again. And when I'm not in the hospital, I'm completely freaking out about why did this happen to me. And then the Dilantin is what I had the anaphylactic reaction to. My mom was staying with me. I was taking this med. I was hoping that things were going to be all right, but I was getting very itchy. The itching was just getting worse and worse, and then I was starting to get concerned. And so when I took off my shoes to really relax and noticed that my feet were turning a different color, I was like, oh, I'm pretty sure. And I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure this is a bad allergic reaction. I made what felt like a very calm 911 call. They got me into the ambulance, and this is actually the part that, of all the things that happened, this incident I remember the most clearly, maybe because I was alone with a paramedic who was having a really difficult time finding a vein to get an IV in me. So we were going over these bumpy roads, and it was clear that the paramedics were beginning to freak out, and I was sinking deeper and deeper into the shock. Apparently it was in the nick of time. The paramedics immediately needed a smoke break because they nearly lost me in that incident. Instead of asking or wanting to die, I felt so passive in the situation and felt like, okay, well, maybe I should just like relax and let it go, like it's out of my hands, I suppose. I'm just this prostrate person in an ambulance that other people are watching drive by. The feeling was so different. Instead of feeling blindsided by pain and wanting to just like rush out of the situation into death, like my will had gotten beaten down so badly by that point. It was like, great, I cannot trust my body, I cannot trust the doctors, I can't trust anything. Like all those panic attacks that I used to have about something spontaneously going wrong were either self-fulfilling prophecies or definitely rooted in a legitimate line of reasoning. The PTSD aspect of it has really manifested in an interesting way, because I already had the philosophical disposition toward meaninglessness and death might happen sporadically, you know, and that disposition hasn't completely gone away. It's just less scary now, because I've had enough brushes that now I know if something were to happen, I know that I am capable of relaxing into it. There's that equation that suffering is pain times resistance, and that if you can just work at lessening the resistance, it's not as bad. You're not actually suffering, you're just undergoing something. One thing that I've changed to make that potential relaxation easier to do is that I make sure I say I love you to people that I love at the end of the conversations that I have with them. That would be the main fear, that I would die and people would not know that I cared about them. I certainly have anxiety about other things that hasn't gone away. Because the stroke happened during a sexual act, some of my reactions to it are seemingly more quote-unquote traditional PTSD, anticipating disasters that weren't necessarily going to happen, seeing emergencies where there weren't emergencies. But some of the other reactions were more typical of reacting to a sexual trauma. What is a healthy orgasm, I suppose? Since I was having a stroke at roughly the same time that I was having an orgasm, and I didn't realize I was having a stroke, it makes it a little hard to then relax into orgasms again. It's a similar kind of worry where I wouldn't be able to relax enough. I'd be thinking, is this pleasure or is this pain? Is this pleasure or is this pain? Those kinds of experiences would be so confusing that I also was really avoidant around sex for a while. Avoidant and then promiscuous. And when I looked at those kinds of patterns, they all seemed to be in line with PTSD reactions to a sexual trauma. So, like, did I have a medical trauma? Did I have a sexual trauma? I had both at once. Navigating my way out of it is still something that I struggle with, and having intimate partners becomes difficult because even if it's something casual, not everybody is as responsible and responsive as Ian was. I'm grateful that Ian was the person who was there. After he got back from his road trip and we still felt connected to each other and ended up living together for a while, I was trying to get away from having to recover from what had happened. So we kind of sank into, I guess looking back, just kind of this stoner lifestyle. Played video games, watched a lot of movies, ate a lot of Burger King, more than I'd like to admit. I wanted to pull myself up. I didn't want to be helped. Ian wanted to help, and I was barely ready to get out of bed every day. It was like a challenge. We still had some good times for sure. At that point, I really felt like I was in a completely different world. I couldn't connect with anybody and would be sometimes unnecessarily mean to Ian. It was almost like I was trying to test the waters and see how much of my actual internal world he could even connect with at that point. And Ian not being able to really connect with the mentality that I was in made a lot of his efforts at trying to take care of me work at cross purposes with what I really needed. I initiated that final breakup with him, and I did it in a really shitty way, like over the phone from a couple states away. It was so bad. I felt so terrible about it, but at the same time, I knew that that was how I was going to be able to release him, essentially, from the bondage he'd placed on himself in taking care of me. I see how Ian's reaction to it has led him to change his career path and get into this medical profession and feel like he's making a difference in a really important way. And you would think that being the person who was hospitalized, I might have a similar reaction, but I just don't. If anything, I'm more lost than I've ever been. I'm a little annoyed that he was able to translate his reaction to the stroke into something so constructive, whereas I'm still sitting around just like, I don't know what to do. This should mean something. You should be really thankful to be alive. But instead I felt like, okay, I'm alive, so I'd better do something to make being alive worth it. And once you're in that mindset, it's hard to do enough. In the ER, I had my instance of saying, let me die, but I remember when I was coming out of it, I remember thinking in the hospital that it really was my chance, that there was part of me that felt like this is your opportunity to drop out of college, break up with Ian, get on a train, do whatever you want, and no one can judge you because this thing just happened to you. You know, like I had a pass. I had a get out of jail free card where like no one could really blame me. They'd just say this happened to Beth and she flipped out, and I guess that's sort of reasonable. There have been a lot of times since then where I've looked back and thought about how different my life would have been if I'd taken that chance. It's like this long shadow. My feeling from having conversations with people is that their biggest concern is, why? Why did this happen? You know? Like, what does it mean? What does it mean that this happened at this time? You know, I think like searching for a larger meaning for an event like that, which is arbitrary, I guess, I was sort of spared that part of it. I already was so familiar with the idea that things happen arbitrarily and that any meaning you want, you need to make it, because I'd already had these anxieties about how arbitrary things are. So I didn't have to go like, oh, it must have a meaning. But in a way, I think that contributed to the paralysis between feeling like here's my get out of jail free card, but also I'm afraid to do anything. I mean, it's like a basic example of terror in the face of your own freedom, right? I have the ability to make the stroke mean anything I want, and it's been just over 11 years since it happened, and I still don't know what I want it to mean, or if I want it to mean anything.
This episode closes season 4 of This Is Actually Happening. I will be back with fresh new episodes for season 5 in mid-September. To stay up to date, follow the Permatemp Corporation on Facebook, follow on Twitter at Permatemp Corp, and subscribe on iTunes. If you'd like to donate to the show, go to thisisactuallyhappening.org. Thank you all for your support. Until next time, have an extraordinary summer. Thank you.